should say.
Support comes from Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum, presenting outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages this June through October 2025. Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with Much Ado About Nothing, Strife, The Seagull Malibu, Wine in the Wilderness, and a world premiere, Echoes of the New World. The Theatricum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information is available at www.theatricum.com and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my new show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings, every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Shanti.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today, journalist and author John Dinges joins us to discuss his gripping new book, I have to say, Chile in Their Hearts, The Untold Story of Two Americans Who Went Missing After the Coup. John Dinges lived in Chile during the Popular Unity Government of Salvador Allende and also in the years following the terror and the coup of 1973. The book reopens the haunting case of Charlie Horman, or Charles Horman, and Frank Teruggi, two young Americans who came to experience and support Chile's experiment of a democratic and peaceful transition to socialism under President Salvador Allende. They were each separately detained, went missing, and executed in the days following the military takeover. The story was immortalized in the Oscar-winning film Missing, which depicted Horman as the man who knew too much about U.S. involvement in the coup. But Chile in Their Hearts challenges that version and uncovers the sham investigation and cover-up behind its false conclusions. We're going to speak with John Dinges about what really happened, what's newly revealed through declassified documents, eyewitness testimony, and his meticulous, thorough investigation of the evidence, and we'll ask why this story still matters today. That's when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, speaking with journalist John Dinges, whose new book, Chile in Their Hearts, re-examines the lives and deaths of Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi, and what their fate tells us about whether the U.S. was complicit or just supportive of the coup, and what it tells us about justice and international solidarity. Chile was a touchstone for radicalized youth around the world in the early 70s, just as an earlier generation had been by the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. Those who could flocked to Chile to be part of the Popular Unity's government experiment in radical democracy led by Salvador Allende, because it posited a peaceful transition to socialism a la chilena, with vino tinto and empanadas, red wine and empanadas, using the ballot box and constitutional means to achieve profound social, economic, and political transformations that working people demand. The September 11th, 1973 coup destroyed 150 years of Chilean democracy and the dream of a better Chile. It also ignited an international solidarity movement, much as the Spanish Civil War did in the 30s, as people were horrified by the brutality of the Chilean junta under Augusto Pinochet, who vowed to rid Chile of the Marxist cancer and proceeded to detain, torture, execute, and disappear supporters of Allende and activists, including the Americans Charlie Horman and Frank Tarrucci. Well, John Dinges lived there in Chile from 1972 through 1978, and he was reporting from there as well. He was a special correspondent for the Washington Post, and he was later a managing editor at NPR. And he's now professor emeritus of journalism at Columbia University and the author of many books, including not just this one, but The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents, Assassination on Embassy Row, and other books as well. And this new one, of course, Chile in Their Hearts. I want to say that John's going to be speaking about this book later this afternoon at La Peña at 6 o'clock in Berkeley. And he'll be in Los Angeles at Diesel Books on May 27th. And I'll be talking to him. John, with all of that, thanks and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot for inviting me. This is really great to be on.
Thank you. And it's really good to hear you say that. I have to say, of course, that, and I mentioned to you earlier, it was an emotional experience reading this great book. And I hope that the listeners, after listening to this, will want to do the same thing. But let's just get started. And let me ask you very first to describe or summarize the official version of the Horman and Tarrucci cases that your book dismantles.
It's a kind of circular confirmation of ideas that started out as assumptions that most of us all held at the time, that the U.S. was responsible for the coup, and the family reasonably suspected, with very good reason, that the U.S. might have been involved in fingering Charles Horman, and then eventually even they might have been involved in Frank Tarrucci's death. The official version was enshrined in the movie Missing. The movie Missing was based on a book by Thomas Hauser. Thomas Hauser based his book on his interviews with Ed Horman, Charlie's father. And Ed Horman based his view of what happened on a witness named Rafael Gonzalez, an intelligence officer who claimed that he had seen Charles in custody, and he claimed he saw a CIA man together with them when they decided to execute Charles. Well, that falls apart when Rafael Gonzalez, the key witness, says he made it all up. He took 25 years before he admitted that, but he submitted an affidavit to the Chilean court in 2003. He had actually written it 2 years before, saying that for various reasons that he explains and I explain in the book, that it was a fabrication. It was absolutely false. Those are his words. There was no CIA agent there. He does maintain that he did see Horman. So when he spoke out in an interview with a Washington Post journalist, Joanne Omang, and said that Charles Horman was killed because he knew too much, that seemed to confirm to the family what they already suspected, that Charles was killed because of some information he got about the coup in Valparaiso, where he was stuck in the days immediately following the coup. So it's a circular verification, which I dismantled. It's a fascinating story of disinformation, of somebody making something up to save himself, because he, too, was a defector and he was trying to get out of Chile. Eventually, he comes clean and says it was an invention.
Thank you for all of that, and also previewing what Missing got wrong and how Missing got it wrong. But Missing, of course, had a gigantic impact, and I think it was a positive one in the world because it highlighted what really happened. And I have to say that in my own case, it was really amazing because my own father could have been Ed Horman. He was a businessman. He was sort of a liberal Republican. And right. When he met his new son-in-law, who told him, that was my husband at the time, that what had happened to him in the stadium and why he was a refugee and how he ended up like that, my father was, of course, affected by it, but I think a little suspicious. But when he saw Missing, He identified with Ed Horman, changed his view. And I remember saying to Roberto, my husband, promise me you will never go back to that country, a country that treated you so poorly. And I think that that is just one example of what, you know, certainly many people did not have a direct tie to Chile. But I think that the film itself, wrong as it was in its conclusions, had just a tremendous impact.
I totally share that view. The movie was the most important film about what happened in Chile. It gets it right in depicting the terror of the time, in depicting the bloodiness and the violence, the arbitrariness, the mass killing, what happened in the stadium. All of those things are absolutely true. Of course, the central story is dramatic, and it depends on the evolution of Ed Horman, the father, who comes to Chile thinking, well, of course, the U.S. Embassy is going to help me. And instead of helping him, they deceive him. And when he realizes that they deceive him, he suspects, and we would have too, that they are hiding something. It's a Hollywood movie. But as I point out in the book, perhaps the irony is that the art of the movie had so much influence in actually determining people's view of the actual facts. Yeah. To the extent that it's the movie's scenario that determines the verdict of a Chilean court case that was issued in 2016. And it was at that time that I actually decided to write the book.
Wow. Well, before we get there, I'd like you to tell just our listeners a little bit about who Charlie Horman and Frank Tarugi were and what drew them to Chile, along with so many other Europeans, intellectuals, journalists, students, activists, and as you say, left-wing exiles from other dictatorships in Latin America in the first place, and then maybe talk about their involvement.
Well, Chile was a mecca for political activists and exiles from all over the world. I estimate there were about 20,000 foreigners in Chile at the time that I was there, 300 perhaps Americans. I'm talking just about the progressives. I'm not talking about the CIA sympathizers, right, who were also there, but there weren't very many of them. The Americans came because they had come out of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, perhaps are disillusioned. Those of us who lived through that, we were disillusioned when Nixon was elected in 1968. And those of us who spoke Spanish, we decided we would go south. Allende's experiment was a model for the rest of Latin America. And of course, that's what made Henry Kissinger so determined to obliterate it. The other foreigners in Chile were largely exiles from the other dictatorships or authoritarian governments that had already emerged in Latin America with U.S. support. And so many of them, and many of the Americans, continued their political activism. They aligned with certain parties. Some of them took jobs in the Allende government. It was easy to get a visa. I was working as a journalist. There were many other people who were filing for various publications. And I had to say, it was a hell of a lot of fun. We were enthusiastic, effervescent, full of energy, and the Chileans were very welcoming, although occasionally they would accuse us being agents of the CIA almost automatically because we're Americans.
Right? Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you've heard that. And we just kind of, okay, yeah, no, I'm not. I understand why you think that, because my government, we know, is trying to overthrow the government of Chile. But that didn't really matter. They let us participate anyway. Charles Horman and Frank Tarugi, by the way, Tarugi is the correct pronunciation, they were both activists. Frank, more than Charlie. Frank had come out of liberation theology, a Catholic education. He transitioned from liberation theology to Marxism, to become a student of Marxism, a not unusual evolution. And Charlie was a journalist. He had worked on the West Coast for a couple of years in documentary film, came back to New York, had a job in a conservative business magazine for a while. You see the picture of him in his thin tie and his suit and his short hair, and you can see the evolution that he is undergoing. He and his wife, embark on this wonderful adventure in a Chevy truck with a camper built in the back, and they want to go to South America, and it takes them a year and a half almost to get there. They drive to Mexico, and they come back. They're living in Berkeley for a while. It's a wonderful example. They go to Cuernavaca, Mexico to learn Spanish. I was there, too. I actually ran into them at one point in 1971. And there was this conglomeration of Americans and foreign, mainly Americans.
I would just ask you one question about this, because you were there as well. And in the book, you talk about they were part of this sort of Ivan Illich school. Were you also there for that reason?
I was there to learn Spanish. I already knew Spanish because I had been doing work with Mexican migrants doing agricultural work in North Dakota as church work. But I wanted to improve my Spanish before I went to Chile. And so that's why I went to Cuernavaca. In the morning, I would do my immersive Spanish class. And then in the afternoon, I would often lie in the hammock and listen to lectures at the Ivan Illich School with a variety of counterculture gurus, including Illich and wonderful people representing liberation theology and education reform in Latin America. It was an inspirational place. And several people in the book that I mentioned were also in Cuernavaca at the time.
And then went to Chile.
It was the way station on the way to Chile.
Wow. Okay, so back to Charlie Horman, and his wife Joyce, who were on this trip and arrived finally in Chile in 1972. So well into the process. And then, I mean, you should talk a little bit about Frank Teruggi, too, but I wanted to kind of get a sense of what they got involved in Chile.
Well, we can talk about them together because to a certain extent they had overlapping activities. Frank was, as I said, more political, more ideological. He was a student. He was 6 years younger. And he arrives in January, and Charlie and Joyce arrive in June. They eventually come together in late 1972. In October. And right around that time, late in the year, they begin to work with a group of Americans to do a newsletter on American radical politics called FIN, the Fuente de Información Norteamericana, which means it's the source of information on North America. They didn't want to lecture to Chileans about what Chileans should be doing about their own country. They only wanted to inform Chile about what was going on up north. That project was involved probably 20 Americans. I wasn't involved myself, but many of the people that I in that experiment I also knew. So Charlie was also involved in researching the Schneider assassination. There had been a coup attempt in 1970 to prevent Salvador Allende from being inaugurated. That coup, it has to be said and emphasized, was organized and paid for by the CIA. And I'm not being a CIA conspiracist. This is totally documented in my work. And it resulted in the assassination of the head of the Chilean Armed Forces. And Henry Kissinger, who was responsible for that initiative to sponsor a coup, has never been brought to accountability for what happened. Charlie was investigating that case because a lot of the court case was public at the time. There was a lot of public information about it. And he writes about it in letters that I have, in which he's very enthusiastic. He wants to write a long magazine piece or perhaps do a film about it. And Frank is going to class because he wants to come back to Berkeley and finish economics. So he's taking classes, and also he's working as a research assistant in a place called CESO, the Center for Social Studies. And he joins up with the student movement that is organized by MIR, the leftist revolutionary movement, which was the most leftist part of the Chilean political spectrum. So leftist, it was not actually a part of the Allende coalition, although it was not opposed to it, but it wasn't part of the political coalition. So he's involved with that group. And then eventually, you know, he's living and he rents a house, and his house, everybody in the house is also a member of the MIR.
I was really struck, though, in reading the book about Frank, because he applied to become a full-fledged member of MIR and they didn't let him in. And it kind of tells you a little bit about it. But his housemate, David Hathaway, also an American, was let in. And I guess Frank worked in the FAIR, or the F-E-R, which was affiliated with them. So it tells you a little bit about MIR itself, just reading this.
So MIR was a militant political party, and it had several levels. It was not a marginal, small, little group. It was very widespread and had activities all over the country. It had a core group of militants, and generally only Chileans could be militants, although they allowed in, for example, people who had been Tupamaros from Uruguay. They let in people who had fought with Che Guevara in Bolivia, etc. So some of the Latin Americans were let into the core group, but not very many Americans, right? David Hathaway was allowed to be a militant because his wife, actually they weren't married yet, but they did. She was a militant. So the real spread of MIR that Frank was involved in was through the student organization called FAIR, which you mentioned, also a campesino, a peasant organization, and other organization, workers-oriented organization. So you had two levels. You had the core party, and then you had the mass organizations that the party was organizing around the country. And many of these mass organizations, of course, they supported the Allende government as well, and they were, they called double militancy, right? They might be socialists, they might even be communists, but they were also working with the MIR student organization or the student or the MIR workers organization. There was a lot of ecumenism in politics in Chile at the time.
And this, of course, you know, is something that was not in Missing. Missing portrays the two of them as kind of definitely, you know, supporting what was going on, but not really involved. And especially, I guess, in the case of Charlie Horman, that he was, you know, I guess they were drawing ducks and they were doing all this other stuff. And it, you don't get the sense of their militancy, you could say, or strict involvement. And was this one of the reasons that you wanted to do the book?
It was a very important reason, not for me necessarily, because I knew that they were more political than they were portrayed in the book. But some of their dearest friends, who then became key sources in allowing me to tell the story of what happened, were very offended by Charlie's portrayal, and Frank's as well. I mean, Frank is totally different from the person that he is portrayed in the movie. And not only that, he was much younger than the person portrayed in the movie. Charlie is portrayed as this cartoonist, and yeah, as you said, drawing ducks, and involved in apolitical kind of hippy-dippy pacifist sort of things. And often he was described as such in some of the descriptions of him at the time, which is not at all. One of his best friends, who is described in the chapter New York in the book, when he saw the movie, he was depressed. He was angry because he knew that Charlie was very committed to the Allende experiment and that he had done things that had actually put him at risk. And he knew that some of those things, if people knew about it in Chile, might have accounted for why he was killed.
And that's question too, right? It's try to understand why they were targeted and why they were killed. Go ahead. I interrupted you, but you know, well, I guess the question is, were they in the wrong place at the wrong time?
And I don't want to go into all the details of what I find, but it's very important to know that the book basically solves the mystery. It tells the story of the disinformation. It tells the story of the pursuit of the truth by Ed Horman to the extent he was able to do it. He actually was able to find his son's body, and it was identified. And one of the big surprises in the book is that it was two Chilean intelligence officers, low-ranking intelligence officers, who actually found the body. That story has never been told before. The movie makes it seem like there were some Americans who kind of found out about it and they told the father. That's not how it happened. It was why the Chileans, one part of the Chilean government, pursued the truth and said, find the body. And the other part of the Chilean military, of course, were responsible for killing the two Americans. And that story of the continuing division inside, on the one hand, inside the Chilean military, but also within the U.S. embassy, where there are people who are trying to cover up what happened in order to defend the Chilean military. And then there are people who are outraged that the cover-up is happening, and they want to do an investigation inside the State Department, and they do an investigation to find out what really happened. But of course, the State Department kept that secret for 25 years, and we didn't know about it until documents were declassified in 1999.
And so, but I wanted to, you know, you mentioned some of the things that you knew when the movie came out and found, I guess, jarring in the portrayal of both Charlie and Frank, but also, of course, this sort of implication about the U.S. role. And that's really at the heart of your book, too. But you also say that you were had already begun an investigation before all of these new documents were declassified. And we can thank Peter Kornbluh for writing that great book that compiles all of these new documents. And new things are coming out all the time. But I wondered, could you talk about what drew you back to do such an extensive, meticulous investigation? I have to say, it's like a model of journalism, but also for any kind of investigator. What prompted you to do such a thorough piece of work?
I was writing a book called The Condor Years that was based on the documents declassified by the Clinton administration in 1999 and 2000, and that included a collection of 300 or so documents about the Horman-Tarrouji case. And as you mentioned, Peter Kornbluh, he was working with the family in actually making sure that those documents were declassified as well. And I looked at some of those documents, and some of them pointed in the direction of a possible U.S. role in fingering them. And if anything, it reinforced my assumption that the U.S. was involved in killing at least Charlie and possibly Frank. I went on with my book right about Operation Condor, but I did a month of interviews, and I talked to many of the Americans and some of the Chileans who were involved in this, thinking I would come back to it. But my intention and my expectation was that I was going to find the evidence for the U.S. involvement in killing them. That was my assumption. I thought that I was going to, when the evidence finally would come out, I would get it and I would write a book about that. So I returned to the case in 2016 because the Chilean court case was concluded and the verdict reaffirmed what the movie said. In fact, it is so close to the movie, and I talk about this in the book, that you can say that the judge actually took his template for his verdict from the movie itself. But that I didn't know that at the time. I thought that the evidence backed up both the movie and the Chilean court investigation. And of course, to my great surprise as an investigator, I expected to confirm the thesis of the movie. And I discovered that not only was the movie wrong, but the Chilean judge was wrong in his verdict. I go into great detail showing the way documents were misused, U.S. documents including. Perhaps he misunderstood the English or something, but he totally misuses U.S. documents to show that, pretend to show that the U.S. had foreknowledge, that they knew about the arrest of Horman before the family did. And then I go through all of the charges and show that the evidence is either missing or goes in a different direction. As a journalist and an investigator, and as somebody who was taught by Izzy Stone, the wonderful journalist that you mentioned, who was I call him my guru, when the evidence points in a different direction, if you're really a journalist, you follow the evidence, you don't insist on your political prejudices. And boy, that was kind of tough in this case, and it's tough for a lot of people, because many of the things that I found did not confirm some of the dogmas on the left.
It was really interesting, too, to read in your book, you know, because you did so many extensive interviews with the parties who were named, but also within the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Chile, and its staff, and to find, and that's so, you know, portrayed in the movie, probably not wrong, that they gave the runaround to Ed Horman and to Joyce Horman, Charlie Horman's wife, and delayed and delayed and delayed. I was pretty surprised when I read your book to see how long it took for so much to come out. I think the movie also ends showing that they even delayed the delivery of Charlie Horman's body after they had said they were sending it to the U.S. It just seemed like wound after wound, you know, was inflicted by the embassy personnel. And that was really shocking. But on the other hand, it led, you know, you should probably, you know, say a word about some of them, including, I just forgot his name, Stephen.
Robert Stephen.
Robert Stephen, yes. So maybe tell a little bit about who you talked to there and what you found out and whether or not you came away thinking, you know, that Charlie was the man who knew too much.
The embassy was divided. There were the people who were devoted to the idea of the success. These were the Kissingerians, the ones that were really enthusiastic about Kissinger's mandate to defend the military government. The Chilean coup overthrowing Salvador Allende was a turning point in Latin American history. It was the end of this wave of progressive governments that were strong at one point in Latin America. And in the embassy, you have people who are not politically on the left, but definitely the division is between those who are upset by the overthrow of democracy and the failure of the U.S. to support democratic values. And then, of course, the real issue is human rights. When the Chilean military is conducting mass executions, and when the truth of those killings is revealed and is known inside the embassy, you have a split. And because I was there at the time during this whole period, I got to know a lot of the people in the embassy, some of whom are still my friends, and I have talked to over the years for all of my books. Robert Stephen is one of them. He actually came to the book launch for my Condor book. So these are people that I admire because they were in the belly of the beast. But at the same time, they were writing the reports that documented what the embassy knew, and they did their best to bring to the fore human rights considerations. And then, of course, during the Carter administration, which followed the Nixon Ford administration, human rights becomes more of a value. And those people who had been kind of outcasts in the State Department all of a sudden are given a stronger role, and human rights is able to be defended. I mean, that story is not really the story of this book, but those people are. There's four or five of these really honorable State Department people that were pursuing the investigation of what happened to Charlie and Frank in an honest way, were upset about the cover-up by the U.S. Embassy, but as loyal State Department officers, they didn't blow the whistle. They made their views known inside the system. They wrote reports, which I now have, and some of them were complete investigative reports, coming to the conclusion that the Chilean military had killed both Frank and Charlie, even though the U.S. government was publicly saying, we don't know who killed them, we don't know what happened, it might have been leftists, it might have been people disguised in stolen military uniforms. We don't know what happened. That was the public stance. And the people inside the embassy knew that that was a lie.
I'd like you to just tell our listeners a little bit more about this one character, Rafael Gonzalez, because he made claims and you sort of uncover the nature of those claims and why he made them and the later retraction, which was not a big story. And yet the things that he said then became the sort of received truth about the whole episode. Talk a little bit about him, if you can.
Well, Ed Horman suspected that his son was killed because he knew too much and said that in interviews with journalists. And there was an article published in the London Times in late 1974, 1 year after the coup, in which it reflects his suspicion, and he uses the phrase, that he suspected that he was killed because he knew too much. Well, Rafael Gonzalez is a Chilean intelligence agent who gets into trouble because for various reasons, including the guy was kind of a rampant anti-Semite, he was anti-homosexual, and for one reason or another, he's an undercover agent. And he gets into trouble with the Chilean military, and he goes into asylum in the Italian embassy. And he's stuck there with his 8-year-old boy and his wife, and he can't get out. And this is not an unusual situation. I mean, the people stuck in the embassies, that was a common situation. In order to draw attention to his story, he agrees to an interview with a reporter from the Washington Post, a friend of mine, Joanne Omang, and Frank Manitzas, another friend of mine. And he tells them the story that he thinks will get on the front pages, right? He says, I know about the American Charles Horman, and I know that he was killed with information between the Chilean military and the CIA. And he mentions the CIA. And he says he was killed because he was the man who knew too much. And that story is propelled into the American press and is the basis for this. Well, Rafael Gonzalez, the first time this story has ever been told completely is in my book of who Rafael Gonzalez is. I corresponded with him extensively. He's still alive. He's 89 years old, still sharp as a tack. He's not a bad person. He did what he thought was necessary to get himself out of that exiled situation, and he was able to leave the country and go to Spain eventually. He tells me, and he wrote this in an affidavit, which he presented to the judge, that he fabricated the story based on that 1974 article in the London Times, which quotes Ed Horman saying that Charlie was killed. He suspected he was killed because he knew too much. That was where he gets the story that U.S. officers were in Valparaiso, the coastal town, working with the Chilean Navy, and that that's where the coup started, and that Charlie and Terry Simon, a woman who was with him, they discover something that is dangerous to the U.S., and that the U.S. officers identify them as knowing too much and tell the Chileans to track them down and kill them. That's where this story comes. And again, it's the circular confirmation of facts that go from assumptions and suspicions to apparent confirmation by Rafael Gonzalez. And Rafael Gonzalez tells me, I made it up. It was what I had to do to get out of Chile. And he's a intelligence agent, so he knows the practices of disinformation. He knows how to invent a good story, combining known facts, which he pulled out of that newspaper article, with things that he knew from inside the Chilean military and Chilean intelligence.
That explains that part of it. But later there's an actual judicial investigation and a trial in Chile. And as you show in your book, that investigation is rather shoddy in a way, because it's still based on what Rafael Gonzalez said, what the movie says. And, you know, as you say, his fabrication wobbles as he starts to tell this story. That's Rafael Gonzalez. But at one point, he says that there was a CIA agent in the room when Charlie was, you know, brought in. And at another point, it's toward the end of your book, where he said that there was an order not to execute Charlie, but to deport him. And that was the first I'd ever heard of that. Well, and that also came from Gonzalez, right?
Well, sure. But this is Gonzalez point three. His first version is that it was the CIA who was there with the head of intelligence, and together they decided to execute Charles Horman. Gonzalez, in 2003, presents an affidavit to the court, which he had written 2 years earlier, and that's where he explains that he invented the story from this article in the London Times. Now, in the course of the telling of his story, including there are taped recordings with U.S. Embassy officials, which do not become public until the declassifications of the 1998-1999, in which this story is wobbling and going off on all different directions, including at one point, and this is kind of Rafael Gonzalez point three, he says, well, yes, I did see Horman, but the officer was not a CIA officer. There was no CIA officer, but there was a Chilean officer. And now he didn't say that Charlie knew too much, but he said that this guy should be deported. He didn't say we should execute him. He said he should be deported, which, boy, talk about an echo of what's going on right now, right?
But, yeah.
I mean, the bottom line on Rafael Gonzalez is that there are so many versions of what he said, his own admission that he fabricated the story. You're left trying to decide, well, what is he lying when he told the original story, or was he lying when he told his fabrication, or any of the variations of his story along the way? The bottom line is that you can't base an important conclusion on a witness that is so unreliable. And he himself admits that what he said was a fabrication, and he explains why he did it. I wanted to say something about the movie. The movie had an enormous effect on the judge's verdict. The judge actually called and paid for Costa Gavras, the famous director, to come to Chile and testify. And they played the movie for the judge, and then the judge asked Costa Gavras, well, is this part, what's this based on? And he says it's based on the book. And he insists that most of the conclusions in the movie are based on fact, but they explain some areas where he invented things for dramatic purposes. The scenario of the movie is reflected very truly in the verdict of the court. And of course, that wouldn't be wrong if there was actual evidence in the court testimony to back up those verdicts. But unfortunately, I read all 17 volumes of the court record, and the evidence is just not there. In fact, there is evidence to the contrary.
So the idea, though, is that the evidence points to U.S. complicity in the coup and in the deaths of the two Americans.
Complicity is the word I use for the relationship between the U.S. government and the Pinochet dictatorship. That is complicity. In other words, I know you're doing nasty things. I'm going to still be your defender in international forums. I'm going to give you military and economic aid. And don't tell me too much about all the crimes you're committing, because I know too much about them anyway. But it doesn't mean that we masterminded the coup, and it doesn't mean that the U.S. had anything directly to do with killing the two Americans. But the cover-up is absolutely conscious on the part of the U.S. officials. Once they realized that this new regime, their new friend, had actually executed two American citizens, they go out of their way to make sure that that is not the prevailing view of what happened in international forums.
I think this is a really important point. And it also, because there's one thing, because the role of the U.S. in supporting so many coups in Latin America over that tumultuous decade would just, you know, sort of lend to that notion, okay, the U.S. was involved. But I think this is a really important point. There's a difference between supporting the outcome and actually being involved to make it happen. And your book goes a long way to reveal that. And I don't think we need to go into all of those details right here, but people should read the book, Chile in Their Hearts. But there is something at the end of the book that you say, John Dinges, and that you draw connections to the Letelier case, which you talked about in the assassination on Embassy Row. I'm very curious about those links.
Well, Orlando Letelier was the foreign minister, one of the key supporters of Salvador Allende's government, and he was named ambassador to the United States. And he knew Henry Kissinger, one of the most powerful and influential political leaders, who becomes, after the coup, the leader of the opposition to the dictatorship in the United States. And he is assassinated in Washington, D.C. on Sheridan Circle, on September 21st, 1976, 3 years after the coup. there's no direct connection, but the portrayal of what happened to Frank and Charlie, in which from 1973 to 1976, it's clear that the U.S. government is less than enthusiastic, to say the least, about investigating the killing of two Americans and absolutely refusing to put any pressure on the Chilean government for respect of human rights or even to solve the case of the two Americans who were murdered. This leads the Chileans to believe that the committing a terrorist car bombing on the streets of Washington, D.C. against the top exile leader would not be something that would particularly bother the U.S. government. And this is not just my view of this. This was a view expressed to me, and I quote in the book, from a State Department official who, over the years, comes to the conclusion that it's the failure to stand up to the military, the Chilean military, that leads them to believe that they can get away with atrocities and even terrorism, such as the Letelier case in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely incredible. As you're reading the book, you realize that it's a very thorough investigation, but it's also a deeply personal book. And you do, you know, you write very movingly of your time in Chile, about your home being ransacked several times and your visits to the cordones or the industrial belt where workers, you know, were taking the factories and were a center of where the military came in afterwards to repress. And maybe I should just ask, because I want to ask you about two final things before we go today. And one is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the other is about what it meant to be there and what international solidarity means to you.
Well, I stayed there until 1978, and my role was to report about the human rights violations from inside Chile. And a lot of people wondered how I got away with it. I did it with a pseudonym for a couple of years, and then I began writing with my own name. They tried to expel me from the country at one point as a reporter, but by then Carter was president, and they had to back down at the ambassador actually protested on my behalf. I'm a journalist, right? But journalists have an impact on human rights and the outcome of things. And I was doing what I could, and that was my intention from inside Chile. Outside of Chile, in those years, 1975, 76, 77, 1978, you have the growing impact of a solidarity movement in the United States and in Europe, focused on human rights, not focused on politics as such, which had allowed it to be, again, ecumenical, have political unity from left, right, and center. And I mean, you had Republicans supporting the human rights movement in the United States. It was enormous. You can say that the military coup and the atrocities of the Pinochet government were the birth of the human rights movement internationally. And that's not an exaggeration. It doesn't mean that Chile was the worst of all of the military dictatorships. Argentina probably was worse. But in terms of public opinion and mobilizing public opinion, the solidarity movement in the United States and in Europe crystallized around Chile. It was extremely important. And here's one more point. The people who were involved, who knew Charlie Horman and Frank Cherugi, when they returned to the United States, almost all of them became activists in the solidarity movement around Chile.
And so did the refugees, you know, who poured in literally mostly after the Carter administration let some into the United States. In Europe, they started pouring in 74 and 75. And they were also instrumental because they were very active. And I was always curious about why Chile was such an important touchstone. And yet, as you say, in Argentina, the repression was savage, maybe more selective, not so massive as it was in Chile in the beginning. And that might have been the reason that it didn't, you know, evoke such a strong solidarity movement as Chile did. But you're right, it changed the whole world and it changed everybody's perception of Chile. And maybe I think something to do with that was the nature of what they had destroyed as well, what Allende was trying to do.
It was democracy.
Yeah.
The United States, even on the left, had this devotion to the success of democracy, that democracy has a role even in a socialist experiment, even in a radical experiment. And that idea was very strong on the left. And it was represented very clearly by Chile, by Allende, not so much by the revolutionary groups in Argentina. And we won't go into that thing of talking about Argentina, which is like a big story of its own. But the movement around Chile and this alliance between the refugees who had arrived in the United States, were welcomed in the United States as political exiles, and their ability to carry out political activity against the dictatorship. Think of that in terms of what's going on today in the United States, where things like that would get you, criticizing a dictatorship might get you thrown out of the country in the current American government.
And I have to say, as well, as you were talking about the role, you were safe, relatively safe as a journalist because you had protection. But today, journalists are increasingly targeted, you know, and it's not safe at all. I don't want to give the impression that it's always safe to be a journalist, but it's more dangerous now than it was before, it seems. And I want to go back just finally, John Dinges, to talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was held in Chile. There was one in Argentina that was even more thorough in a way. Certainly we had the South African one.
Much less thorough in Argentina, excuse me.
I was thinking of, you know, of course, the trial and the truth that came out. Great.
I can say something about that.
I do want to say one other thing, too, that just shocked me at the time. And in your book, you reiterate there were 7,000 detained in the stadium. My husband, who was there, thought there were 20,000 to 30,000. That was what most people said. All the numbers shrank once they had this investigation. And that's, you know, it doesn't mean that they were any less brutal, but it was kind of in the solidarity movement. The numbers were very big, that there were 1 million in exile, 1 million tortured, 30,000 in the streets or bodies down the river, the Mapocho River, and all of those things. Maybe that always happens, but
those are political numbers. And there's almost a universal law that when outrages happen, the numbers are exaggerated. And I don't think that this is people lying or being deceptive. Their perception of the colossal nature of the violence bespeaks those kinds of numbers. So the 7,000 people in the stadium, that's a number from the Red Cross, which went into the stadium in 3 weeks after the coup and was able to look around, and you look around and you count, right? How many prisoners were there? And that's a pretty good number. There were a total of 60,000 political prisoners in Chile. That number is absolutely documented over the period of the years of the Pinochet government. The numbers were colossal. The number of killed is 3,296. That number is not going to vary by more than a dozen or so after all of these years of investigation. The numbers are very, very rigorous. And every one of those 3,296 is attached to a name, a date of detention, an investigation of what might have happened and who was responsible. The Vicaría of Solidarity, the church-sponsored human rights organization, which was operating during the dictatorship, is responsible for the accuracy of those numbers, because they were at great risk to themselves, were gathering the information from witnesses, even as the dictatorship was going on. But Chile, again, formed the model for the most accurate human rights organizations and the most accurate accounting of human rights crimes in other countries, including South Africa and elsewhere.
And is this the outcome of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, this sort of precise numbers that they came up with?
Yes. It was the CNVR, the Comisión Nacional de Verdad y Reconciliación. And it was the information gathered by the Vicaría, the church-sponsored organization, which I used to visit every week during the time I was living there. Their files, which were extensive, they were turned over to a government-sponsored and financed commission of investigation in 1990, and they began a series of investigations and reports. And these reports are the gold standard of human rights investigations. They came out with, in I think 1991, with a number of 1,000 something of disappeared. And as they did more investigations, the number grew to the number I cited, 3,296. It took them a period of about 10 years to come up with the final numbers. And then they did supplemental investigations in the 2000s. And they did an investigation of victims of torture, as well as people who had been killed during the dictatorship. 35,000 people who are victims of torture in Chile.
That, can I just inject, too, a personal note there? My husband's name is on that. And I actually, it was after he died, unfortunately, but I got a check for, I can't remember the exact amount, but it says for the violation of human rights, I'm translating, which was pretty impressive. And that's all thanks to that investigation.
And they called it reparations.
Reparations, exactly.
And the children of the victims, both those who were killed, but also those who were tortured, were given the opportunity to study, and their university education was supported. And the Chilean government, called the Concertación, the coalition that became the first democratic government, they ruled, that coalition was in the government for 20 years. And during that period, it was a conservative, right of center political plan, but left of center and absolutely progressive in terms of human rights. And they passed a law giving reparations to the victims of the crimes of the Chilean junta, and they were implacable in supporting the investigations of what actually happened.
In this section in your book about the Truth and Reconciliation investigations, you hint that the United States would do well to have one as well. Can you elaborate a little on that?
The United States has always been involved in the events of Latin America. In Guatemala, we sponsored a coup. In Dominican Republic, we had an invasion, etc. There are many examples, including Chile. The investigations have occurred in those countries where the crimes occurred, but there has never been an investigation of the involvement of the U.S. in those situations. In some cases, we were directly involved. In other cases, as in Chile, we destabilized the country to try to ensure that it would fail as a experiment, because we didn't want this to spread around and become a model for other countries. And, you know, in the case of Horman and Teruggi, you know, the conclusion is no, we weren't directly involved. But I'm a journalist, and I depend on investigations and documents that are the source of this, but I can't replicate. I can't be the official investigation. I do my best, and many people like me do our best, but that's not the same as having an official investigation to really look on the behalf of the American people at what the United States' role was in all of these situations.
Of course, this is not the government that's going to undertake anything like that at the present time, but thanks to at least the continual declassification of documents, it's entirely possible to have such an investigation. And maybe this is a task for the international movement to press for.
Our immediate task is just making sure that democracy is not completely obliterated in this country. That's going to take our effort over the next 5 or 6 years. I really take this very seriously. We're 2 or 3 steps down the road to where Pinochet was in 1973.
Well, John Dinges, thank you so much for all of that. We didn't really go into the final punchline of the book about why, but I want to leave that to the listeners and tell them to get the book, Chile in Their Hearts, The Untold Story of Two Americans Who Went Missing After the Coup, by John Dinges, an investigative journalist who was there at the time. It's just out by University of California Press, and it's a gripping story, a page-turner, literally, and it's meticulous in its documentation. The footnotes and methods are all, you know, documented at the end, and that's just as interesting as the story, and even reveals other things as well. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and thank you for taking the time to go through all this incredible story.
Great. Thank you. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, John Dinges. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.